in general, I think Elon understands AI better than pretty much anyone else on the planet.
If, you know, you've got your megapacks out in the middle of nowhere that are storing energy and you've got Starlink connected to them, maybe there are times when it makes sense to run those chips as distributed inference chips and convert your energy into some sort of intelligent labor.
I think this is bigger than what we could ever possibly imagine, which is why I bought Tesla and why I think NVIDIA could get to $10 trillion.
How do you compete with that? How do you compete with that? So you're sold on the Tesla story long term.
Yeah, and there's a lot of reasons why, but obviously I've been on the podcast before and I bought a Tesla back in November and I've been using FSD every day. And I mean, it's hard not to be sold when the thing's driving you every day.
Yeah.
So then it's a question of, can they scale the robotaxi network? And I think you've done a really good job articulating why. And if they do, I think it's game over.
Yeah.
Does Elon's work with XAI factor into that confidence at all? Yes, no, just indifferent?
Yeah, I know Tesla does not have a direct stake in XAI, and hopefully they do after the proxy vote in November. In general, I think Elon understands AI better than pretty much anyone else on the planet. I mean, he is the reason for why OpenAI exists. He saw LLMs before everyone saw LLMs. And so the fact that he set up XAI within about a year of OpenAI really going viral and him realizing, holy crap, they're gonna, you know, they ousted me. They're not a nonprofit anymore. I can't go through the legal struggles of trying to sue these guys. Like, I need to build my own thing. And he got it up and running. Objectively, you can say Grok 4 is better than the latest GPT model. They don't have as many users because they didn't get the first mover advantage, but they have been able to raise at a $200 billion valuation. He's been able to get all the money in the world to support him on building this stuff. They've been able to set up super clusters and to the point where NVIDIA is impressed at how they're able to set up these data centers. I just think it's hard to bet against that. And I think obviously the synergies between XAI and Tesla are obvious. I've been seeing videos of people talking to Grok in their Tesla. I don't have that yet, but I can only imagine having a conversation with Grok and being able to learn about the world just like you would be on the Grok app. I think it's a game changer. And I think those synergies are obviously going to be very valuable. And that should elevate the value, the enterprise value of Tesla stock.
Yeah. How do you view Tesla getting into the game? And I know you talked about this on your stream when the news broke, but Tesla getting into the chip building game with Samsung for AI 6 and supposedly onwards. How do you view that as a potential competition to NVIDIA, a boon for Tesla? How are you viewing that through your lens?
I think it was really strategic. I think, yes, it's competitive with NVIDIA, but obviously, NVIDIA's demand is just unbelievable. So even if they don't win literally every single contract, I think they're going to be okay. Same thing with AMD. I think based on what Elon said, he wanted more autonomy and control over the manufacturing process when it comes to building these chips, which begs two questions. Number one, why does Elon want to be involved in that part of the supply chain? Number two, what is he getting ready to do? And the obvious answer to the second part is getting FSD models to be even better than expected, which means you need more compute. And then Optimus, right? A lot of these robots are going to need chips, and they're going to need to be trained on many models that allow the robots to function like a realistic human in the real world. So it's obvious why he wants all these chips. Now the manufacturing expertise that you guys have talked about so much, which is their competitive advantage over Figure, which is another big humanoid robotic startup, I think is taking place. Like the fact that he wants to be, in his words, on the factory lines, making sure that things are being produced in the most efficient and effective way so that when Tesla's demand scales, because he knows there's going to be a lot of demand, how can they actually match that demand, which is really the hardest thing NVIDIA's been struggling with over the past couple of years. Will they be ready for it? And I think Samsung just said, hey, we'll give you the flexibility to work with us. Just don't buy NVIDIA's chips. And for Samsung, it's obvious they get $16 billion, and you know that's their incentive.
I think what's been very interesting to think through, so we had Jeff Lutz on our pod a couple of days ago, and we had Jordan yesterday too. We're kind of sort of throwing around the idea of like what this chip thing actually means long term. Like the light bulb that went off in my brain is that if you fast forward 10 years down the road, and Hans brought this up, which was actually, maybe Hans, you can verbalize it better than I can. That idea around how anything with a battery, anything with an energy system, it makes sense to put a chip next to it because that's where you can actually start leveraging the energy infrastructure to process compute, and you're not really running into this energy shortage because you're actually using every bit of energy that's out there to run distributed inference. Can you articulate that point?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of been something that people have talked about a long time since Dojo really was first incepted. And then, you know, Dojo just hasn't got to the point yet where it's really competitive enough to do this. But yeah, the idea is that, you know, you've got, there's really two key inputs to basically all of the economy, and that's labor and intelligence and energy. So like you can, if you have robotics, then you can turn energy directly into labor. And so if you have energy and then intelligence, you know, the combination of that allows you to do basically any of the stuff that's valuable that gets done. And this has, you know, been an arbitrage that people have thought about with Bitcoin. And, you know, there have been some efforts to do this where it's like, okay, if you have a great source of energy, but you're having mismatch between supply and demand, then, you know, you could try and either curtail that source of energy, or you could try and store it, or you could mine Bitcoin with it. The issue that Bitcoin runs into is that Bitcoin mining is such a hyper-competitive space because it is such a commoditized application that people who are trying to mine Bitcoin in that way, like you need 100% utilization of your ASICs in order to compete with other people who are doing that. And that challenge really, you know, makes on again, off again, intermittent Bitcoin mining pretty much a non-starter at this point in time. But AI inference has so much more flexibility than so many other things. And you can think about, you know, there's definitely a cost benefit trade-off that you have. But if, you know, you've got your megapacks out in the middle of nowhere that are storing energy and you've got Starlink connected to them, maybe there are times when it makes sense to run those chips as, you know, distributed inference chips and convert your energy into some sort of intelligent labor, you know, turn it into tokens that you can monetize in some way. And, you know, it's hard to say if that will or will not make a lot of financial sense, you know, for the same types of reasons that it doesn't make sense for Bitcoin. But at least the AI use case is such a general use case. It's not such a narrow thing like Bitcoin mining that maybe, you know, that stuff doesn't get commoditized as well. And you can monetize those intermittent assets at a higher rate to where it makes sense to, you know, make the capital investment to put those chips, you know, co-located with those things. But so that's just like thinking about energy infrastructure specifically. Obviously, if you're making robo-taxis or you're making Optimus robots, well, then you've already got batteries and chips together. And anytime you're not using the robo-taxis or the Optimus robots to do physical labor, you just hook them up to the charger and then you can run the inference on those things if the assets themselves have downtime. And definitely you would want to do that. And so it's kind of like an extension of that into other places where you might have batteries, you might have energy, and you can do this distributed intermittent inference to just supplement. You know, you're obviously going to have dedicated training, dedicated inference stuff too. So this is like a bonus on top of that that helps you to, like amortize your CapEx over more scale.
Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellionaire. Now, we know a lot of you are Tesla fans, and especially Tesla investors. And if you have more than $1 million of Tesla stock, Rebellionaire could be the perfect fit for you. Rebellionaire is an investment firm that helps Tesla investors reach their financial goals. They do this by helping you plan for your future, and they also institute strategies like trimming and adding, covered calls, etc. So if you're somebody who believes that Tesla has long-term potential, these kinds of strategies could maximize the number of shares you have by the time Tesla reaches those goals. And the guys at Rebellionaire do this by doing so much research on the Tesla story, and they do a lot of novel research as well. Things like doing cross-country full self-driving trips to really gauge and truly understand the capability of that specific software. They've done really novel research around the energy side of the business and other parts of the business as well. And so instead of dealing with a typical investment firm that may give you the cold shoulder by viewing your investment as too risky, the guys at Rebellionaire will help you reach your goals while fully understanding the Tesla story. And so if you're a Tesla investor and you have more than $1 million of shares, and you're interested in finding out more about Rebellionaire, I have a link for you in the description in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionaire.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that we sent you. And now back to the podcast.
Do you think Dojo competes with NVIDIA then at some point?
The goal is definitely for it to do that. I mean, that's, and it's Elon's insurance plan against NVIDIA. And so far that insurance plan hasn't been needed. You know, it's like he wanted to have Dojo so that at least if NVIDIA failed to deliver stuff that could train video, then he still had a backup plan. NVIDIA, I think, has over-delivered on expectations, and Dojo at this point has under-delivered. But, you know, it's just the first revision of a product, and it does take, you know, those cycles in order to get it better. And so the hope is that that Dojo 3 architecture is something that could compete with NVIDIA. And, you know, one of the interesting things about Dojo 3 is that if it can compete with NVIDIA, like NVIDIA's, you know, general platform does AI across all different modalities. And because it is more general in the customers, the use cases, and the modalities is like, you know, multiple axes of generality, then that does leave some room to where if something can specialize in some way, you know, maybe it can pull ahead of NVIDIA chips for that application. And I think the if you wanted to pick one thing to specialize, I think video is definitely a huge opportunity, because I think that over time, as we're continuing to push forward with the bitter lesson and we're just turning all, you know, problems into these AI problems where you just throw the most compute you can and the most data at it you can. And then, you know, as your compute and data resources grow, the addressable number of problems that you can solve at superhuman levels continues to grow. There's only one form of data that is infinite, that, you know, you have limited number of text data. You have a lot more limited, like you audio data is good and it does scale, but it you can't learn as much from audio data as you can from video data. And so like video data is just the ultimate source of infinitely scalable data that, you know, whether you're looking at the level that humans, you know, naturally see, or whether you're zooming into microscopic things and learning about, you know, the subscale world, or zooming out to look at the macro scale world and space, like if you can put a camera on it and see it, you can learn about it and you can create a world model based off of what you can see. And, yeah, so like as we are continuing to build chips on, you know, this AI realm is moving a lot faster than Moore's Law. You know, you're not just getting a doubling every year, or 9 months or 18 months or whatever it is that, you know, Moore's Law is doing for transistors in CPUs. Just like the overall functionality of AI chips is growing way, way, way faster than that. And so you need a source of data that is going to scale along with the scaling of the compute, you know, this parallel accelerated compute as well. And so that's where I think, you know, that video bet is a good bet to make. And it's the bet that most fits with what Tesla's doing anyways, that, you know, all of Tesla's real world AI is video in and then AI actions out. And so, you know, there it's just like a convergence that makes sense for them that I think could give them a platform. And maybe it's not even Dojo 3. Like maybe, you know, NVIDIA is moving so fast that Dojo 3 is close but still behind. But then maybe, you know, if they're catching up, maybe at some point Dojo 4 or Dojo 5, their video focused architecture for both training and inference allows them to push ahead. But then, you know, the other argument here is they don't even have to be ahead. As long as they're within 30% or something, or like if they're 30% as good as NVIDIA, but NVIDIA is charging you 70% markup, well, do you just continue to buy your own chips instead of buying the NVIDIA chips? So, you know, it's like got multiple levels on which it can work for Elon to do this. And then there's that ties into XAI too, that XAI wants to solve super intelligence. And I think to whatever degree video data ends up being an integral part of solving super intelligence, then there's also partnership like possibilities that make infinite amount of sense between Tesla and XAI. And so I think all of that is the direction that Elon's heading. And, you know, Tesla, they say, you know, their motto is we do important things ourselves. Compute is definitely one of the, you know, most important things that you could do. They have some of the largest fleets of integrated camera data collection sensors floating out there around the world. If you've got the data, and right now, you know, even with FSD, they're only actually down selecting a tiny fraction of the total video that they are taking. So they have like this huge untapped data resource of video that already, you know, if they had the ability to train on it in a valuable way, it's just like sitting there waiting. Pushing forward with this, and you know, who knows if they'll continue to just use Samsung indefinitely, because they've done Samsung for AI3, Samsung for AI4, TSMC for AI5. TSMC has done Dojo 1 and Dojo 2. So they've kind of split half and half between TSMC and Samsung. So they can take whatever it is that they learn each of these iterations, and then they can work with whichever fab partner makes the most sense. I think Samsung really makes a lot of sense right now for the, you know, several reasons that it's right there in Texas, it's close by the Gigafactory, and supply chain independence from Taiwan, that's really important right now. But, you know, if some of those supply chain concerns end up getting eased, if TSMC is doing a lot more work here in the United States, you know, TSMC definitely has the ability to potentially get back some of that business from Tesla. Or, you know, even we could see something like what has evolved with Panasonic, that Elon brought in Panasonic to do the Gigafactory in Nevada. Then he still buys like all those batteries, but he also started up the 4680 project. So they make their own batteries. They buy all the batteries they can get from Panasonic. Now they're buying batteries from LG. Like, they get batteries from anyone and everyone they can get. And I think that that's also going to continue. Like, eventually, I think batteries end up becoming much more the limiting factor of what you can do with all this AI robot stuff than the compute itself. But I could see the same kind of overall dynamic playing out with compute, that maybe they do end up rolling their own fab at some point in the future, and they're buying from Samsung, and they're buying from TSMC, and they're buying from NVIDIA, and AMD. Like, if compute is, you know, one of the critical inputs to creating value, and if you're limited with what you can make in-house, then you just kind of continue to buy from everyone. And it's a nice competitive marketplace. So everyone should be, you know, roughly within the same ballpark of capability.
Yeah, to me, it seems like that the demand for inference chips feels infinite. It feels infinite because, so if you fast forward into the future and you say, okay, you have collected all of and processed and learned from all of the totality of human written knowledge and video knowledge. That's going to be finite up to the present. And then as the future rolls forward, we create new things, but those new things we create are going to be very limited because we're going in minute chunks, right? And so if you go for a minute chunk of human knowledge or video or audio that's been recorded and it gets trained on, versus the totality of all of human knowledge, the amount of training compute you're going to have at that time is going to very easily process that and go through it, right? So data at some point is going to become exhausted. And so you move on to the next thing. It's like, okay, so where does the next
thing... We're just not anywhere close to that right now, though, because yes, we've generated...
How far away are we from that?
We've generated tons of knowledge over, you know, the course of human history, but the amount of it that's been captured is like almost nothing. And so, like, we don't even have the ability to capture the totality of data that's being created on a moment-by-moment basis right now. So, like, there's a long way to go to the place where you're talking about. Like, text
has anyone
data
done
on
that?
The internet is, like, a tiny, tiny, tiny overall fraction of the data. It, you know, if we could just magically snap our finger and have access to every bit of data that humans have ever created in over the history of all humanity, that alone it would be enough to, you know, basically know everything there is to know in the universe.
So how do you know how, okay, so has anyone done the exercise of like how much data there is in an hour block that exists in the totality of what we could capture versus the totality of human knowledge that we've recorded? Does anyone know what that number is?
It's got to be ridiculous, the amount.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, just think about, you know, it's actually infinite, I would think. You know, if you could put video cameras to capture every single bit of video data on every square millimeter of Earth. But, okay, that's just Earth. You know, what about Mars and what about other solar systems? Like, the amount of data that can be captured even in a single moment is infinite if you believe that the universe is infinite.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm trying to capture is like, okay, what are the three vectors? What are the three axes that the AI, like, what is NVIDIA, Tesla's, et cetera, Google, Meta, what's their defensible long-term moat or defensible long-term demand when it comes to what they're trying to produce? And there seems like there's three different, so there's data, right? So there's data, inference, right? And then energy. Okay. Those three seem to be the three places where if you're somebody who's playing in that game, you're going to be in business for decades. You're going to be in absolute business for decades, right? Because the inference compute is going to be placed on all the devices, either embodied or not embodied, to create an action for the thing that the human's looking to do. The data is going to be used for the training, which is also going to utilize the chips for the inference at some point in the future. The inference chip and the training chip are going to be married together so that we can use those interchangeably because it's just compute at that point, right? So that's going to be innovation. And that's what AI6 and onwards. And I know NVIDIA's talked about like they do training and inference on the same chip. Okay, so that's going to become one thing. So that's going to be fed by the data. And then the energy is going to be feeding those systems. Energy is going to be feeding those systems. And so I guess where I'm landing at is like, why doesn't NVIDIA just create massive server racks of inference compute and just hoard the world's inference compute? Why are they selling these things? Or is that going to be their plan? It's like once there's not enough demand, like once their supply outstrips
the
demand,
you run out of money to buy new ones.
So they have to sell them. I've never really understood that thing from NVIDIA. It's like if you have such an incredible asset, why don't you start running inference for other people? Why don't you run your own server? Like you're literally creating the chips. You're going to eat. Your costs are going to be the lowest out of anybody. Make yourself into an Oracle type provider, AWS for inference computer, even training, and just hoard that shit. Why don't they do that?
I mean, Jensen's vision has been to create a platform for the world to solve humanity's biggest problems with artificial intelligence, leveraging parallel computing. And I mean, I guess it's hard to, you know, since I'm not a huge expert on NVIDIA's business, you know, I think selling the chips to everyone helps them to continue to always reinvest with TSMC in spinning up the next biggest fab possible and, you know, doing the research on the next process and packaging architecture that really makes sense. You know, they're kind of a middleman between people who are using, they do use AI themselves. Like they are their own customer. They do have their own inference. Like, but I think it's a fraction of the overall demand for that inference of the whole world. And they want other people to help them, you know, serve all that capacity to the rest of the world so that they continue to focus on making, cause it's not about the, you know, what is the inference and training infrastructure of today look like, what is it capable of? The thing is Elon's deal, your pace of innovation, you have to continue AMD's, you know, breathing down their neck to make better chips. Cerebras is, you know, got their shot on goal. Grok with a Q has what they're doing. Like you cannot stand still in this infrastructure landscape and have anything that is defensible, because, you know, 2 years from now, someone will have a chip that's just so much more energy efficient that they can do way more tokens than you can do with a fraction of the energy because they continued moving forward. So like you just can't stand still. You're stuck on the treadmill of always trying to develop the next best thing. And that's that.
But the long-term issue, then,
arms race,
the long, yeah, go ahead. Sorry. I didn't mean to.
Yeah, that arms race is the thing that keeps everyone pushing so fast, which is why, you know, AI is progressing so much faster than Moore's law.
But then the long-term issue for NVIDIA, then, if they're going to be, because of that dynamic, they are going to be forced into a commodity market. And so their margins are going to absolutely collapse because of it. Isn't that the logical outcome for NVIDIA?
I don't know.
They're incapable of, they don't have enough of a forcing function to hoard their own inference computers and run a quasi-Tesla, quasi-Oracle, quasi-Google operation where they have a brain that they themselves have built.
I just don't understand that argument. You know, that's like counter to the whole logic that platform businesses are the biggest businesses. That, you know, why doesn't Apple hoard every single one of its iPhones? Why doesn't, you know, why does Tesla sell its cars? Why all of these things that
Tesla's probably not going to sell their cars.
Well, they're probably not going to sell too many robotaxis. That's true.
And are they going to sell bots? Are they just going to lease those
people servers? Have been saying this about NVIDIA for a long time, and they continue to figure out how to serve more customers in more ways and build more platforms for people to do more. Like they're just focused on building platforms for other people to do things. Sometimes those other people are cloud providers. Sometimes those other people are AI researchers. Sometimes those other people are biomedical researchers. Like they've always been trying to build platforms.
Yeah. Okay. Amit, what do you think about this conversation?
I think, you know, NVIDIA is just, it's one of those things where a lot of people thought it was cyclical. One of the reasons I didn't buy it for so long is because same concern, right? Eventually, the cycle of needing all this AI data compute infrastructure is going to wear out, and then NVIDIA is a bubble. And the DeepSeek dip was a moment for me to say, hey, maybe I should learn about NVIDIA, because if I was ever going to buy, this is the opportunity. And once I learned about it, I was like, okay. Jensen and what he's been talking about, it's real. It's very real. And are there risks in the future? Yes, especially to their margins. But if we're going to be building as much AI as we're building, which is data centers to be able to do everything we're doing, and Zucks comes out and he's paying $1 billion.
Token factories.
Yeah, factories. Zucks is paying $1 billion to one person just to get better research from them. I mean, I think this is bigger than what we could ever possibly imagine, which is why I bought Tesla and why I think NVIDIA could get to $10 trillion. Even though it's crazy to imagine that given right now it's at $4 trillion. But yeah, I think it's going to play out. I think Tesla's going to win. I think NVIDIA's going to win. I think this AI revolution is going to be very real. I don't know how it ends. If like once the AI data center stuff is built out, like where does NVIDIA go from there? I'm sure there's a lot of different verticals that they're thinking about to get ready for that as well. But Tesla, from a software perspective, seems to be the actual use case of all these GPUs. And that is why I am excited to like really begin building the Tesla position. It's just the earnings aren't good. But I think you have to overlook that at this point if you want to invest in the future.
Yeah, I think one of the recent developments that had gotten me extremely excited about Tesla's profitability from the AI pieces. So they've started doing dynamic pricing with the Robotaxi network. They started this a few days ago, where it's no longer a flat rate of $420 or $690. It's now per mile. And now we have to keep in mind that this is based on fleet size. This is based on the size of the customer base that can actually hail the ride. So it's going to change as the fleet gets bigger, but their price per mile is significantly lower than Uber's. Lower than Uber's. And I don't want to read too much into it this early on, but I feel like why would you do that unless you're trying to send a signal to the market that says, you guys, once we yank the safety driver, It's GG's times 1,000. Okay.
So like, you still really think Uber's dead because of this?
Oh yeah. Oh, they're cooked, brother. They're fucking cooked and a half. Yeah. I
love your conviction on this because you're one of the only people, I think you both, and I think there's a couple other Tesla bulls that just really believe Uber's done. They're not going to survive.
How could they not be? Like, how could they not be dead? when Tesla charging a dollar per mile will still generate 40 cents of profit when they have a 10-to-1 robotaxi ratio to a supervisor. That's a 10-to-1 ratio of robotaxi to supervisor at the headquarter is a 60 cent per mile cost to Tesla after taking into account insurance, maintenance, charging, cleaning, et cetera. That car will still generate 40 cents of profit per mile. How do you compete with that? How do you compete with that?
ARC, estimates that the total addressable number of miles for ride hail at a dollar a mile versus $2.53 is, 5 to 10 times greater. And so like you get to, much larger total fleet sizes that you need compared to what Uber's fleet size is to, satisfy demand for all those miles.
I'll give you a perfect example. So my brother just got invited to the robotaxi geofence today. So he lives right in the middle of the dick. He's like right in the middle of the shaft in Austin. Okay. The geofence?
I was trying to understand what you said, but now I get it.
You got the rough. Yeah. I mean, you have to remember you're hanging out with psychos today.
Yes.
So he's right in the middle of the geofence and he got invited to it and he has a dentist appointment today. And he typed it at the dentist is in the geofence. It's $3. Uber would have been like $9-$10.
Yep.
And it goes to me, like, why do I own a car?
But is it $3 because of the promotional stuff or?
No, that's the dynamic pricing. But here's my point. This is my point. The $3 price for the 3 mile ride, okay, that is a function of supply and demand.
Yeah.
$3, okay? But the point here is that how does Tesla add supply to the network? How do they add supply? They just, remember, they shit cars out of the factory? They just shit a car out of the factory. They plop it in the geofence. And that car, that exact car, is going to run at no more than 60 cents per mile. Okay? So at a dollar per mile, Tesla's still making 40 cents of profit. So if there was so much demand for this vehicle in the area where they could charge a dollar per mile, Tesla can still add as many cars as they want to the network to get the price back down to a dollar per mile and still make 40 cents of profit per mile. How does Uber compete with that?
It's hard to imagine. I agree with you.
It's over.
Hans, are you in the same ballpark? You think Uber's dead completely?
I mean, I think it'll take time, but yes. Unless they would have to find some magical pivot, which is not impossible, but like their ride hailing business is done. It's literally just a matter of time. I think that one of the reasons why Elon wants to do this big thing in San Francisco is whenever that is running at scale with no driver in the seat, I think it just undeniably shows that because it's the only market that they are in right now that Waymo's in where Waymo actually has their own app. I think it basically shows that Waymo is done. And then, Waymo's already showed that they are eating huge share from Uber. And so if Tesla takes over all the Waymo rides and all the Uber rides in San Francisco, it's a data point that basically just shouts from the rooftops that both
have
of these
seen that
business
study?
Models are dead.
By the way, Emmett, have you seen that study of the Waymo versus Lyft versus Uber in San Francisco?
I think you shared something a while ago of it, but no.
So let me just show you this. Because this was the slide that for me was like, oh yeah, Uber is like completely and utterly dead. It's just completely over, beyond over. I know people make fun of me for saying this over and over again. I don't see it any other way. And so I have to speak my mind on this. So this was, hold on, let me put this in some stuff. Okay, so this is Waymo. Okay, this is Waymo versus Uber versus Lyft. Waymo is this blue line. Lyft is this pink line and black is Uber. So this is within the San Francisco operating zone where Waymo is operating today. This is August of 2023. And this is April of 2025. This is Waymo's percentage of San Francisco gross bookings. This is Lyft and this is Uber. Okay. So Waymo is now over 25% of gross bookings in the area that they operate in. They're now officially higher than Lyft as of April 2025. And Uber has been on a consistent downtrend since Waymo launched. And the bigger takeaway here is that the average price of the Waymo is $20, Uber is $15, and Lyft is
$14. Okay. And so people are paying more for the Waymo.
I literally just came from San Francisco last week, and we took Ubers, we took a Waymo one time, and like if you want to use the system consistently, like there's, you know, I'll add in one more caveat. Waymo's doing that while they don't drive on the highways, and so if you need to drive a long distance across that geofence, you're still not going to take a Waymo because it's going to take you two or three times as long, and they're still just gobbling up market share from Uber and Lyft. So like there's like their TAM isn't really fully
realized
apples to apples yet. So anyways, yeah. But that said, the Uber drivers there are terrible. Like the cars are nasty. A lot of times the drivers drive like maniacs. It's not a pleasant experience to take the like the base level Uber is just terrible. And so if you can take a Waymo ride and it's going to get you there in the time that you need to get there, and it's just a little bit more expensive, 100% take the Waymo each and every time. There is kind of like a workaround on the, if you take the green version of Uber, and I don't know how many people know this in the area. I would assume not very many since, you know, there's regular drivers that are still working the system, but you get usually it's a much newer car. And then usually your driver is a little bit better too. And it's basically the same price as the base price for the standard Uber. But if people don't know that you should click the green option instead of the regular option, then, you know, one of the rides I was in was like a 15-year-old Toyota Camry with a Asian lady who drove like an Asian lady. And we're sitting in the back seat and the springs are just squeaking the whole way down the road. You know, I feel like I had been transported back into college and I was riding to Walmart with, you know, somebody's 20-year-old shitbox.
Dude, yeah. I was in an Uber the other day going to New York and the guy was just, he was not a good driver. And then like, it was just like, and I wanted to say something, but I was like, I didn't want to be mean. And then right. At one point he tried to make up for it by saying, you know, the roads are kind of rough. And I'm over here looking. I'm like, dude, you're speeding. Then you're slowing down. You're speeding. I'm like, this was a horrible experience. I was just happy to get out of the Uber and be done.
And then you feel bad giving him a one star.
And I didn't because I'm not a dick. Right? But like, he probably deserves one because I don't want other people to experience that. It was bad.
Yeah. That's the thing about Uber. Uber does not have a consistently good experience. They just don't. They are a necessity business because there's nothing better. Yeah. And they charge, and the cost per mile is so much above of owning your own car. And the reason why people are willing to put up with that shit is because a lot of people hate having to drive somewhere so much that they're willing to pay Uber $2.61 per mile on average plus tip to not even have a good experience.
Or I mean, they just can't afford to drive somewhere because when they get there, parking is ridiculously expensive and it's just way cheaper to Uber there, but still you hate it.
Uber has the most brittle business model of any public company right now.
Well, I was going to New York and so I couldn't park anywhere and I needed a drive. I didn't want to take the train, so I had to pay Uber.
Yeah.
So I agree. Hans, was that your first time in Waymo in San Francisco or no? Oh, your first time. Okay, yeah. So did you have a good experience or no?
It was a good experience. Yeah, it's I felt like my experience in the robotaxi in Austin was better, that the quality of the driving was better in the Tesla. It is just smoother and more human-like. You can feel there's a little bit more robotic behavior from the Waymo, but still it was really good.
Sorry. More human-like in the meaning the best things that humans do from a smoothness perspective.
Yeah, not more right? human-like in drives like a jerk, like an Uber driver, but more human-like in
top 1%.
Like the best, yeah, like the best chauffeur who drives you around. You never feel, you know, you're never getting thrown back in the seat or brake checked or anything. Like it's just super comfortable the whole time and always, you know, it never makes you nervous. I felt like the Waymo, it never really made me nervous. It wasn't quite as smooth, quite as comfortable, but still way better than the Ubers. And I feel like the robo-taxi software has crossed over that chasm of the uncanny valley. You know, like people talk about that with computer graphics, yeah, where you can kind of just tell it's CGI. You know, the facial muscles just don't move quite right, and it looks good, but you can tell it's not human. The robo-taxi, you know, it has crossed that type of gap for a AI driving platform.
Yeah. And then stick that in a polished version of robo-taxi software in a year's time on CyberCab, where the cost per mile is going to approach 20 cents per mile. Okay. Good luck. Good luck. Right. If Waymo is already massively outperforming Lyft and they are taking market share away from Uber in a limited geofence at a cost premium. Okay. It's fucking over completely. And anyone who doesn't think that, I think, is going to be very wrong. Gary Black, my brother. I love him. He's great. Anyway, you know, it's I don't know why I get so worked up every time it comes up. I might be a little bit on the spectrum. What do you guys think?
No, but it's the thesis. It's the future of Tesla, right?
It's just such a no-brainer. Like, most people don't like Uber because it kind of sucks and it's expensive. And most people don't like driving.
Yeah.
You know? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. I'm just saying, like, it's for this economic model to work out, it needs to play out the way that you're saying. And logically, it should, given it's just hard to imagine Uber is able to get to that scale. One of the things about the Waymo experience I had is that it was way too expensive. It was like $20 for 1 mile. It was ridiculous in San Francisco. And number two is the Jaguar is not that nice.
You know, if you compare it to the Model Y, you know, if you're coming from Uber, it's way nicer than most Ubers. Not all Ubers, but most. But yeah, if you're coming from a Model 3 or a Model Y, and then you go sit in the Jaguar, it's like, meh.
Right.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Which is crazy, because the I-Pace actually sold at a massive premium over the Model Y just because it had a Jaguar logo on it. That's like, that's another fascinating tidbit there. Yeah, so that's crazy. What's did you want to hit something on your end, Amit? Since, again, you see what Amit does? This is like the seventh time he comes on the pod as a guest, and then it's you and I, Hans, just autistically going back and forth about the most dumb shit. So can we ask our guest something? what's on your plate? what's the biggest top of mind thing that's like on this Friday? Like, what is the thing that's really like?
I think we discussed it with the labor market, right? That's a big deal.
Yeah.
I think the two biggest topics today were just like labor market, what's going to go on with the Fed, and then why I started buying Tesla. And you know, it's funny because you'll buy Tesla at 335, it'll go to 300. People will say, bad buy, this, that. It's like, dude, I genuinely do not care. Like, at some point, you got to bite the bullet and buy. And the difference between 300 and 335 is $35. Like, if this thing is going to 10, 20 trillion, which over the long term, I think they are in the prime position to do it, it's not going to be that easy for Microsoft to do that when there's not exponential S curves built into the business or the potential of the business. It's Tesla. So now the question is just, how heavy can I make the position over the coming years? But I guess we can end on this idea of, what do you think actually tanks Tesla? Because the last time we got anywhere near 270 was Elon tweeting about Epstein. Besides that, I really don't know what he could do to get this thing into the at least like 220 Tim Walz type of range.
There's three. He leaves the company for whatever circumstance. He goes to jail for whatever circumstance. That's it.
I mean,
honestly,
if they massively fail at robo-taxis, which I think is highly, highly unlikely.
100 people die in like one day or something.
Yeah.
I agree. That's my take as well. I think it's a key man risk with Elon, and that's it. Like, I don't see what the company could do. Because you can say, oh, they'll have bad earnings. It's like, well, it's been about a year of that. you know?
Yeah, I agree. It has to be some sort of black swan event.
Yeah.
I think black swan keeps Tesla under 300.
Yes. Agreed.
No black swan. It ain't going under a trillion. It's just not going to. There's obviously way too much buying demand. The market wants to own Tesla. Dude, go ahead.
And not just by retail either. A lot of smart money wants to get more Tesla.
Exactly. When you had Tom Lee? The analogy he used with the Da Vinci. Tesla is a Da Vinci. It was the most succinct way of putting the thesis to perhaps people that don't understand the long-term potential of the company, is that you're betting on the uniqueness of all the things that are coming together that make this entity completely different than everything else. It's just there's no peer.
Or to put it a slightly different way, you know, if you're betting on a fight and you've got someone who's undefeated going in against someone who's up and coming, but, you know, spotty Jake record, Paul. Who are the market makers going to give the odds to? And like, if you want to have your money on the undefeated, unstoppable champion, like, you're going to have to pay a premium to put that bet in versus, you know, hey, I'm going to take a shot on, you know, the kid being able to pull off an upset.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. It's just like, it's if institutions recognize where AI is going and retail believes in Elon because they've understood Elon's story before everyone else, then I think 300 is where they're pinning it at. And as long as growth inevitably comes back by 2026, it should do a lot better than that.
What will outperforming earnings do to the name in this setup? Right?
I mean, yeah, that's the question.
Yeah.
I think
it's going to be nuts.
I don't think it should be, you know, $400-$600 yet, because eventually you need the earnings growth. But once it gets that and the America Party stuff is in the past, all that, like, I mean, where is the ceiling?
I didn't even think America Party is going to do shit, to be completely honest.
Yeah.
If that comes to fruition, you know?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, like, even if you think it's a distraction, how much of it destroys the thesis? And it's like, not a lot. Not a lot of it destroys the thesis.
Yeah. A lot of the robotaxi thing existing today was during Elon's most chaotic period in his life.
Yeah.
Robotaxi still happened while he was doing that. Let me ask you one question before we let you go, Amit. What keeps you so motivated to grind as hard as you do? Because you are on every day, multiple times a day, forever. How do you do it?
I think I just... it's.
Are you okay? I'm kidding.
That's a good question. Yeah, it's a lot of gratitude, you know. When you do it when there's only 40 people watching or listening, and then it ends up being a lot more than that. You're very grateful that people use you as a resource for information. I'm sure you guys feel that as well as content creators. And so that gratitude that people actually care and that they want the content is very important. And then B, I'm very passionate about markets. So, you know, when things are happening all day, we're all plugged in and I'm trying to analyze it. I come from a debate background, so communicating what's going on. Essentially, the market's filled with arguments back and forth, and you're just trying to reconcile those arguments. That process of communication is very exciting to me. So I get to do it every day. People care about it, and that's why I keep doing it. And I don't even know what the full long-term vision is. I mean, I have some ideas, but I just love doing it every day. And so that's why I'm here.
You do a great job, and I have especially enjoyed the recent kind of series on just doing the deep dives on individual names like Lemonade. That one in particular was really, really solid. Some of the other ones I've been very interested in as well. And so really cool way to, you know, collect some of the best minds in retail, which have some of the most orthogonal takes to what you hear everywhere else. You know, get them together in a room, have them discuss. And it has been really, really cool.
Well, the thing is, we're all retail investors, right? And we all have to stick together. We've been winning a lot over the past couple of years, definitely this year, as institutions didn't buy the tariff dip. So the process of minds coming together is really important. I actually had dinner with a person who works at Altimeter, Brad Gerstner's fund in New York a couple of days ago. And her number one question during the dinner was asking me, how is retail finding these stocks? How did you find Oscar? How did you find Lemonade? How did you find Hood, Palantir, Rocket Lab? And I was like, retail, you know, I know people think it's just a bunch of random people buying stocks, but there are certain communities that are so hyper-focused on one name. They dissect it to its very core. Institutions didn't care about Hood or Palantir at $6-$7, but retail did. They definitely didn't care about Tesla back in 2018, but retail did. And now we're just trying to see what are those other names that are out there for us to learn about.
I was just going to say, people don't appreciate the fact that retail is distribution. Like, obviously, you know, the majority of retail investors are going to be retards who, you know, comparatively speaking. But if it's even only 1% of the retail investors who are even within a fraction, you know, a meaningful fraction as competent as professional analysts, but then you take those people and you give them the power of the internet where they can all congregate together, and collectively, you know, you can get 100 or 1,000 of these types of psycho nerds to deep dive a story and elevate, you know, the best narrative on that story. Well, of course, that analysis is going to, in aggregate, be much higher quality than what, you know, even a team of several incredible researchers can put together inside of one of these, you know, traditional institutions.
Yeah. And what will like advanced AIs do to retail investing and identifying, like, and now analyzing a thesis, throwing ideas around, finding opportunities? Like, at how many, and then how is that going to impact, like is that going to a, are we going to go into a world where, like, maybe 5 years from now, like, there's way more IPOs because there's going to be like the investing mark, like the people that invest in companies are going to be so much more well-educated. That's going to create a forcing function for private companies to want to go public because they know there's going to be a lot of capital out there that's going to flow into their companies because so many more people are going to be well-informed. That's a fascinating thing to think through.
I think it's a tailwind for research. And there's so much money out there that's not in the markets. It's just locked up. I mean, ask any of your friends. Their money is just locked up in their bank account. And so if AI could be a tailwind for people to realize, hey, maybe Tesla is actually an opportunity, or maybe Lemonade or Bubble, whatever it is, and they take the risk, which is the hardest thing for any human being to do, is like take that. You have days like this where you're down a lot of money. You're like, why did I take that risk? So the psychology of it's very important. But if AI can streamline the ability to recognize the opportunity, that should be very good net for liquidity globally.
Yeah. You know what's funny, Emmett? You say it's a bad day today. Today is a good day because Tesla is the stock that's the least down.
That's true.
We're usually the most down. So today I'm like, yeah, we outperformed. So it tells you how much it sucks to be a Tesla investor when we're the best loser.
Yes.
You know?
That is true.
Oh my God. Where can people find you?
Twitter at Emmett is investing. That's it.
Not YouTube?
And YouTube at Emmett is investing. So I'm sure Farza will have the links in the description, but yeah, I appreciate anyone who consumes the content, and this is fun, dude. This is really fun. We talked about this a while ago, but it's the greatest time to be able to distribute ideas and invest. Yeah. And there's so many things to talk about because of these AI tailwinds we're seeing. And it looks like it's not slowing down for the next 10 years.
Yeah, dude. We're just getting started. We really are. And then I can't wait for you to be the premier finance channel on the planet because of it.
Just got to keep working.
It's coming. It's an unstoppable train.
The reverse Cramer index.
Yeah.
By Amit.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.